Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Well-sealed windows. No other country can make such well-sealed and nice windows. This apparently was Angela Merkel's answer to a question asked by a journalist more than a decade ago, when the journalist asked her what she most associated with Germany. And that's the kind of detail that we expect in a column from The Rest is History's top pundit, Dominic Sambrook, who is here with me. And Dominic, you wrote this article, I think, just before the elections that were on Sunday.
That's right, still Saturday, yeah.
That will be bringing the curtain down on Angela Merkel's 16-year reign as Chancellor of Germany. So we thought we'd do a kind of guerrilla look at not just Angela Merkel, but the entire history of post-war German democracy. And this is obviously a subject that particularly interests you.
Well, I think, like everybody in Britain, I was on the edge of my seat for the German federal elections. I know it's something that's...
To me that people in England were, and Britain were more interested in this
year. Do you think so? I don't think...
I do, yes. I've read loads of articles about Merkel, about Wither Germany, all that kind of stuff.
Well, it may be in the broadsheets, but I think it's a really interesting thing that people in Britain get so interested in American presidential elections, generally.
The BBC do.
And, you know, these sort of incredibly consequential elections in the biggest, most powerful, most economically dynamic state in Europe kind of passed most people by. I mean, most people couldn't name the leaders of the CDU or the SPD, the two big German parties. Could you name them, Tom? I don't actually think I could.
Of course you could.
I think it's a really interesting and revealing thing. And actually, German politics is much... I mean, it has this reputation in Britain of being just stupefyingly bland.
Isn't that the point, though?
I think this is historically really interesting.
The point that you make in your article about Merkel is that, in a sense, the kind of the cosy tedium,
yeah,
is precisely the point, because of course it's being set in contrast
exactly
to what had happened up till 1945.
Exactly. So when our producer said, you know, why don't you do something about Angela Merkel's departure and German politics? And I started thinking about the German post-war chancellors. I mean, they're all against the backdrop of the war, indeed, both world wars, in one way or another. I mean, they've all got the war in their personal history or in their family background. And actually, it turns out to be colossally more interesting than you think. And the blandness, the ordinariness, and the humdrum nature of German politics is, as you absolutely say, it's part of the point. It's deliberate.
And of course, Merkel has the communist period growing up in East Germany as well. So all the chancellors have, as this kind of backdrop, the experience of fascism and communism.
Exactly. So I think what we should do, Tom, is rattle through the chancellors first. So to give people a sense of the context, because I think that's really important and interesting. And then probably in the second half or so, we'll see how we do. We can get on to Merkel. How does that sound?
That sounds an excellent plan.
Okay, so I'll kick off. Germany in 1945, actually, just to think about the facts and figures of it, is astonishing. So there's 5 million people dead. There's 9 million men in Western Allied or Soviet prison camps. So Germany is, you know, to an extent that we in Britain, with our sort of, you know, we sort of get very misty-eyed about Coventry Cathedral and the Blitz and all this sort of stuff. But this is a completely different order of magnitude of destruction, but also of kind of a moral destruction, you know, this sort of moral humiliation.
The country is on the verge of being divided.
Yeah, it's about to be divided between sort of Allied and Soviet zones. In Berlin, 4,000 people are dying every day of disease in the second half of 1945. So it's, I mean, the Germans call this Stunde Null, so zero hour. But they mean that in that's got a kind of ambiguous meaning, because on the one hand, it means kind of they're absolutely in the depths of degradation and despair. But at the same time, they like to think of this, and it's projected to them as a clean break with the Nazi past, which is a bit of a, well, which is a complete myth, actually, because as we'll see, there are tons of Nazis around in the, I mean, they don't all disappear.
No, and some of the, one of them becomes Chancellor.
Becomes Chancellor, exactly.
Yeah, we'll come to him. But Dominic, have you read this new book that's just come out in English by Volker Ulrich, who wrote Great Biography of Hitler? 8 days in May, How Germany's War Ended.
So I haven't read this. Have you read this, Tom?
I have. I actually just read it just before the idea for this podcast got suggested, which is why I was ready to say, yes, okay, let's do it. Because, I mean, it's brilliant. It's kind of pointillist depiction of the last 8 days between the suicide of Hitler and the kind of complete surrender of Germany.
So it's the kind of Dönitz government, isn't it?
Yes, so Dönitz is kind of supposedly in power, but you have all these kind of little portraits of different people, so people from the Nazi regime, people who are its victims, and Germans who were opposed to Nazism. So you get these portraits of various people who will become leading players in the history of the Federal Republic. One of whom, of course, is Konrad Adenauer, who will become the first Chancellor of the Federal Republic. But there's an amazing description of how he, you know, he gets brought by the Americans to become mayor of Cologne. And he sees the cityscape of Cologne, and it's absolutely flattened. The cathedral is, you know, devastated. Buildings are totally, and he can't comprehend how the city could be rebuilt. And the Americans say, "No, we must, you know, you must rebuild it." And so he puts his shoulder to that particular wheel. But the sense that even Adenauer, who plays such a crucial role in getting Germany back on its feet, his first instinct is to say it can't be done.
Well, this is the extraordinary thing. So there's another book that I read, book called came out this year, also translated into English, called Aftermath, by a guy called Harold Jena. And he talks in that book, it's basically how the 10 years after the war. So a lot of it is about denazification and the lack of, and so on. But he has a whole chapter about rubble. And basically, there is so much rubble, so many buildings have been destroyed, that clearing it up is the work of years. And it's this colossal kind of national effort.
To begin with, it's the women who have to do it.
Right, exactly. Because all the men are away. Because all the men are in. I mean, it's an absolutely mind-blowing story, which doesn't really get told in the West. Because it's, you know, we won, the Germans lost, hurrah, hurrah, end of story. And in Germany, the way they told that story themselves was pretty distorted. So in his book Aftermath, Jena says basically they repressed all memory of everything they'd done, or we repressed, rather, he says. And he says we coped by casting ourselves as victims.
But having said that, I mean, there are heroes, and I think Adenauer does rank as a hero, doesn't he?
So Adenauer is the let's get into him. He's such a titanic figure. So when the Germans had a competition called Unsere Besten, they had a big vote where 3 million people voted. It was the equivalent of the Great Britain's contest that the BBC had at the beginning of the 21st century, to find the greatest German in history. And Adenauer won. Do you know who came second? You'd like this.
Well, I'm guessing who didn't come second.
He was banned.
Goethe.
No, Martin Luther.
Oh, excellent. Yes,
Karl Marx came third. Interestingly. Anyway, Adenauer. So Adenauer is an extraordinary man. He is ridiculously old when he takes office. So he becomes Chancellor in 1949. This is when West Germany is finally up on its feet. He's 73 years old. He was born in 1876. Yeah. And you say about the Americans making him mayor of Cologne. He'd been deputy mayor of Cologne in 1909. I mean, imagine a man who'd been in politics in Britain.
He'd been mayor of Cologne from 1917, hadn't he? Up to the Nazis taking power.
So you'll like him, no doubt, because his religion is very important to him. Absolutely. He's a Catholic. He's a Rhinelander. He's been part of the Centre Party. I mean, the great formational moment in Adenauer's political development was Bismarck's Kulturkampf against the Catholic Church. And he hates the Prussians as a result of this.
Well, Dominic, I know that I kind of bring this theme up every time, but would you not say that looking at the history of post-war Germany, the Catholic and Protestant dimensions yes, to it are actually incredibly, and even looking at the electoral map, as it, we're recording this on Monday, so the day after the election, and you have this kind of the CDU, the conservative union founded, you know, the Adenauer kind of led from the beginning, so very Catholic,
yeah,
kind of concentrated in the south where historically Catholics yep. have been concentrated, and the SPD
in the north.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah,
so
absolutely,
kind of much more Protestant and Lutheran.
And actually, when I went through this with doing the chancellors, I wrote down next to each one Catholic or Protestant, and it's funny how it always points it out in their all biographies of them always mention it, because it's so foundational in German yeah. politics, that Catholic. So Adenauer hates Prussians because he sees Prussians as Protestants, anti-Catholic, all these kinds of things. It's why he's actually quite keen on the idea of setting up West Germany. He's actually not, in some ways, he's actually not that bothered about losing East Germany, because it's full of Prussians and he hates them, and he blames them for Nazism. So Adenauer presides over Germany till 1960.
Well, but also, Dominic, just to say that his record under the Nazis, I mean, he sits it out, but he does get arrested, doesn't
twice.
He?
Twice. He's in prison yeah. twice. Yeah. And after the Night of the Long Knives and then again in the war.
And he tries to escape, gets arrested again, taken yeah. to the Gestapo cell, somehow manages to get out. So, I mean, you know, he's...
He's got a great record. It's not surprising that the Germans voted him as their best German, because, you know, it's a great story. So he's a very old man. One thing he does do is he scraps denazification. So he says, basically, we can't go on having endless trials and interrogations and so on. We need to get the country back up on its feet, and we need to shut this down. And effectively, he shuts it down pretty soon after taking over as chancellor. And he prioritises recovery and rebuilding rather than kind of, you know, accounting for all the sins. He says we can't account for all the sins of the past. Now, authors like Harold Jena say this is sort of poor stuff. But I suppose you could make an argument that, from a point of view of pure pragmatism, because so many people were implicated in the Nazi regime to get Germany on its feet, especially given the pressure of the Cold War, he probably had to shut it down to some extent. But of course, he then goes on to become a sort of founding father of European unification and so on.
And the alliance with France.
The alliance with France. Yeah, he takes Germany to NATO. He rearms West Germany. So, and he's 87 when he retires. That's so amazing. He makes Joe Biden look like a...
Yeah. And he remains head of the CDU until he's 90.
Yeah, ridiculous. I mean,
Because the guy who succeeds him, Ludwig Erhard,
yeah,
never actually, although he leads a CDU government, never actually joins the CDU.
No, he's a very apolitical figure, actually, Ludwig Erhard. Just one last thing on Adenauer. An amazing fact I found. In 1957, in the Ministry of Justice, so 1957, this is sort of Volkswagen rebuilding Germany. You know, Germany's cuddly again, and the economic miracle is underway. In 1957, 8 out of 10 officials in the Ministry of Justice had been Nazis. So that's yeah. the sort of dark side, if you like, of the Adenauer regime. Now, Ludwig Erhard, we're talking about the World Wars. Here's a great sort of World War story. He's Bavarian, so a Catholic part of Germany, but he has a Protestant mother.
And he's raised as
Protestant. Who raises him as a Protestant, exactly right. And he fights in World War I on both fronts, and he's badly injured at the Fifth Battle of Ypres. Gary Sheffield would enjoy these facts. And
as my grandfather was.
Really? Mm. But your grandfather didn't become economics minister in post-war German government.
No, so that
a notable man, difference. No doubt, in his own right. But,
yes.
And did your grandfather have his one arm shorter than the other?
Don't think so.
Ludwig Erhard did.
He looked excellent in the hat.
Did he? Yeah. Your grandfather or Ludwig Erhard?
My grandfather. I don't know whether Erhard.
I've seen pictures of Erhard in a hat, actually. Did he? With Lyndon Johnson. Yeah, he looked very good. He yeah. kind of grinning,
he's kind of slightly, he's a kind of roly poly guy.
Yeah, very roly poly. He's not really one of life's politicians. During the sort of 1930s, the Nazi era, he'd actually worked as an economist for the German finished goods industry, for the Association of Finished Goods Manufacturers. I don't actually know.
So there was boring stuff
happening
before yeah. the Federal Republic.
Yeah, he sort of kept his head down, and he's a technocrat. Mid-60s, he falls after 3 years because he's seen as too pro-American, I think, by and large. And he's just not very political. And so he falls. And
so
now
we have a Nazi.
Yeah, so now we have this very, very interesting character. So imagine, I mean, if you were... So for here, for a brief shining moment, he's the world's most famous Kiesinger, as he's called, Kurt Georg Kiesinger. But then, of course, he's completely eclipsed by Henry Kissinger. Which is something like you with Spider-Man, Tom.
Yeah, it is. You know? Yeah, so a certain degree of fellow feeling.
Yeah, well, but you're not a Nazi, and never
no,
have been.
True. No, that's true. So tell us about his record as a Nazi.
Well, first
and
of all,
where he comes from and how he ends up as Chancellor.
He's from Baden-Württemberg in the southwest. Now he's the reverse of Ludwig Erhard. So he comes from a family of Protestants, but his mother was a Catholic, and she brought him up as a Catholic.
And it's interesting, is it not?
This, yeah.
How many of them have a bit of both, a bit of Catholic and a bit of Protestant?
Very interesting, and also the mother. Being the sort of outsider who pushes them into her confession, and that sort of slight sense of outsiderness, I wonder if that plays a part. So this is me, my Freudian psychology.
Yes,
anyway,
but plugging into church history in an excellent way. Good to see you. I finally got you.
So Kurt Georg Kiesinger, I mean, he's a careerist. So he joins the Nazi Party in 1933. There's only one reason you join the Nazi Party in 1933. It's that they're in power. You know, because if you're, you know, that's why he's done it, obviously. And he has this, we can say, colourful history, working with Ribbentrop and Goebbels, producing propaganda, anti-Semitic propaganda.
Because he doesn't fight, does he?
No, he's a pen pusher.
He's a pen pusher who basically kind of ends up making propaganda for the Foreign Office.
So that's basically what he does. And he just does this consistently. Even after he knows that what's happening to the Jews... So after it's kind of common knowledge, he carries on doing it. So there's basically no, you know, he's a kind of, at best you would say he's an amoral careerist. At the worst you say he's just an utter Nazi.
And what's interesting about, so he is Chancellor, what, 66 to
69?
So this is the, and has 1968 in the middle, slap bang in the middle of that term of office, when... anxieties among teenagers, people in their early 20s, students, about Nazis.
So this is your genesis of the Bader-Meinhof group. This is your, you know, he's very critical of, you know what he said about the baby boom generation? A shameful crowd of long-haired dropouts who need a bath and someone to discipline them. So, you know, he's not holding back.
He's
leaning into his reactionary reputation.
So the CDU conference, he gets slapped, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
By a protester. So I'm not surprised.
A Nazi hunter. She's Beata Karsfield, and she slaps him in the face at the CDU convention, while shouting at him, "Kiesinger, you're a Nazi, step down." So, I mean, it's all out there.
That's not good optics, is it?
No. And yet, this is what's fascinating. And actually, this takes me back to that book, Aftermath, about the aftermath of the Second World War. A lot of Germans, you know, you don't often hear this now, and actually, it's not part of almost the received narrative of sort of German post-war history. But a lot of Germans actually don't feel very apologetic about the Second World War, or indeed about Nazism. Opinion polls show that very clearly. Lots of people think, you know, Hitler's problem was he went too far, and Kiesinger wins almost 50% of the vote in 1969.
Is that presumably more true of people on the right than the left? Or am I being unfair?
No, I'm sure that's true.
CDU voters there.
I'm sure that's true.
Because for the SPD, the left...
Yes.
I mean, that is different, isn't it? And so the guy who succeeds Kiesinger, Willy Brandt...
Great character. I mean,
he's a fabulous character.
Yes,
and
he is.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, his whole life is anti-fascist.
Anti-fascist. So, of course, he's not Willy Brandt.
No, it's that's not his name, isn't it?
It's an alias. Imagine if we had a British Prime Minister who governed in the 70s. Imagine if Ted Heath was an alias. or James Callaghan. So actually, his real name is Herbert Frahm. And he's the son of a single-parent department store cashier who never knows his father.
In Lübeck, the home of marzipan.
Yes. Exactly.
Incredibly beautiful city.
I've never been to Lübeck. Have you been to Lübeck?
I have. I've got a friend who lives in Lübeck.
Oh, very nice. When you visit, will you bring me back?
I said, you must buy marzipan. And I don't really like marzipan. But
I like marzipan a lot.
To be polite, I bought quite a lot.
When you next go, please bring me back some Lübeck marzipan. Anyway, we're going off-piste. So Willy Brandt, he's a socialist. He's, you know, card-carrying, absolute, sort of quite hard left in the standards of the 20s. He flees Germany when the Nazis come in. He has to. He goes to Norway and Greece and Spain. And Willy Brandt is one of his many aliases. And when he comes back to Germany at the end of World War II, he decides, you know, it's a better name than Herbert Frahm. Mm-hmm. And he ends up being mayor of West Berlin.
And I think he's right, isn't he? Because, I mean, it's a great name.
Yeah, it is a good name.
Yeah.
And he's built up hugely by Kennedy. So Kennedy identifies him quite early on and says, this guy's a tremendous fellow. You know, we should sort of build him up. And Kennedy, obviously, when he goes to make his speech in West Berlin, Ich bin ein Berliner, Willy Brandt is at his side. And the Americans are very keen on Willy Brandt. But Willy Brandt is kind of, he's the voice of youth. He's the voice of, he says, you know, we need more reform. We need more democracy in Germany. And he comes in 1969 as part of a coalition, I think, after, so Kiesinger is out and he comes in.
I mean, he's kind of become more centrist, hasn't he? Since his early firebrand.
Yes,
socialist days.
Absolutely.
And but, so he does, I mean, he's very pro-American. I mean, whether that's because...
Well, you have to be pro-American in West Germany America is defending you against...
I mean, isn't he backing Vietnam and... I mean,
yeah, I think
like
West...
That
and that's one of the things that West German government
supports.
Yeah, of
he's
course.
He's a Keir Starmer figure.
that really...
Cracking down on the left.
Keir Starmer has never been on the run.
No.
I don't see him leading a...
I withdraw that analogy. But he is also, I mean, the famous thing he does is Ostpolitik.
Ostpolitik, kind of, so basically recognising East Germany, exactly.
Which none of the previous chancellors had done.
No, they basically said East Germany is illegitimate. He says, let's normalise relations, then we can both join the UN. The other thing he does, the one thing that he's very famous for in outside Germany, and I found this fascinating when I discovered this. So this extraordinary moment in 1970 when he goes to Warsaw, mm. to the memorial to the ghetto uprising in Warsaw.
Yeah.
And he kneels in this fantastic photograph. Incredibly, you know, it's a very moving moment. And is always taken, I think, in sort of Anglo-American textbooks and things. You know, this is a sign of the new German and all this. What is absolutely fascinating is that a plurality of Germans did not agree with him. So 48% of West Germans thought that was wrong to have knelt.
Why did they think it was wrong?
Well, can you not? I mean, they
shameful,
thought it was wrong.
Yeah. Unpatriotic.
Unpatriotic, too much, grovelling. You know, you don't have to. It's too dramatic. It's too, you know, we shouldn't be doing that. We should be forgetting. You know, a whole load of reasons which you can complete. If a British prime minister did it for something, at Amritsar, let's say,
yeah.
Right. You can imagine the commentary. So it's kind of not dissimilar, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
anyway,
not to downplay the Amritsar massacre, but it's not quite on the scale of the Holocaust.
No,
is
of course
it?
Not. Of course not. I mean. But that's what's so interesting, that in 1970, even as lots of young Germans, the sort of Bader-Meinhof-y type people and their fellow travellers are saying, this place is full of Nazis, we haven't got over the, you know, we've buried our guilt, we haven't admitted it and all this. Even at that moment, 48% of their fellow citizens are saying Brandt should not have knelt at the ghetto memorial. So he's very popular anyway with sort of liberal minded intellectually kind of people, so artists and all this.
Gunter Grass,
exactly. But he has this, he's a, to use your brother's terminology, he is a massive lad. So
well, I think it's our terminology as well.
There's a lot going on with the ladies.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of drink being taken, and he also suffers from depression. So,
and also he has a secretary, doesn't he?
Yes.
Who has turns out to have an unfortunate background.
Gunter Guillaume, I think his name is. So he's basically an East German spy.
Have you seen the brilliant Michael Frayn play about that?
No, I haven't.
Democracy.
I've heard of,
it's really good. I think it was on at the National, it must have been 20 years ago or something like that. And it had Roger Allam, who is in...
was he Willy Brandt?
In Endeavour now.
He
was
very
Willy Brandt.
Good as,
he was fabulous. Really fantastic. It still lives vividly in my memory. So ever since, Willy Brandt has been my favourite chancellor.
But Willy Brandt doesn't retire. He doesn't resign just because of the spy. The spy is kind of the trigger. You know, he's sick of it anyway. He's exhausted.
I may have got that wrong then from the play.
You know, there's a memorial to him.
It.
You love these walks. There's a memorial to Willy Brandt in Hammersmith.
Is that?
He donated, when he was mayor of West Berlin, a lamp or lantern. And swapped it with Hammersmith. They twinned with some part of West Berlin. And it's still there with a little plaque underneath saying Willy Brandt.
Oh, I'll go and search that out.
Yeah. I don't think it's worthy of a podcast before you get excited.
No, but possibly worthy of a little stroll.
Okay, very good.
Yeah,
I'll go have a look. Do we have time for one more before the break, do you think?
Well, I think we should whistle through, because I think that the later ones will be kind of escalatingly more familiar.
We're about to get into my favourite one, though, Helmut Schmidt.
Helmut Schmidt, he was a Nazi as well.
Well, I think you're being harsh.
So he literally joined the Wehrmacht in 1937.
Wait a second. So he was in the Hitler Youth. He was kicked out of the Hitler Youth for not being a Nazi, for being anti-Nazi.
For being arrogant, I thought.
But then it's very ambiguous, because he's then back in the Hitler Youth and there are reports from his superiors saying he's a great Nazi. He's a teenager. He's dithering. He doesn't know what he is.
We've all been there.
He's wrestling with his ideological convictions.
Yeah.
But yes, he has an amazing war. He fights on the Eastern Front. He's at the siege of Leningrad.
And on the drive on Moscow.
The evidence is
stacking up here.
But he's a German. He's in the German army. I mean,
yes,
he doesn't, and he's about 12. I don't know. I mean,
he's signed up to the German army. He's attacking Moscow. He's laying siege to Leningrad.
He's at the trial of the Stauffenberg conspirators, but not on trial. He's just watching. And then he fights at the back.
I gather, is what changed his
Is that
mind.
Right? I didn't know that.
That he goes there, and I think this is from Ulrich's book.
Yeah.
He attends this hearing of the conspirators against Hitler, and it's only then that he realises that the Nazis are criminal. And he says this himself, apparently, in an interview that he did later in life. Too late, Schmidt added. Yeah, so
He admits his compromise.
He absolutely admits it.
And he goes on to fight. He still fights. He fights in the Battle of the Bulge. He fights in the Ardennes.
He's on a journey by that point.
He's on his journey, right?
He's on a journey.
He's captured by the British, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he ends up becoming a Social Democrat.
He does indeed. So he takes over from Willy Brandt. He's very pro-European. He's very hard on the Baader-Meinhof group. He takes an incredibly hard line against them in the so-called, what's it called, the German... I can't remember what it's called. It's either called the German Spring, the German Summer, or the German Autumn. I can't remember which one of them. I'm sure it's not the German Winter.
Springtime for Germany.
Anyway, it's one of these things where the Baader-Meinhof are at their peak and they've kidnapped Hans-Martin Schleyer, or whatever his name is, the head of the German business group, and it's all very big news. Anyway, he's a chain smoker. He's great pals with...
Callahan,
Gerald Ford. They go on holiday together when they've fallen from office. This is the... I'd love to write a play about this.
Yeah. That's very Michael Frayn. He did a good play with that.
So they go on holiday. Henry Kissinger said he hoped he... what did he say? He hoped he died before Helmut Schmidt because he wouldn't like to live in a world that didn't have Helmut Schmidt in it.
He's obviously a man of incredible charm.
Which is a very nice thing. And the other thing
charm
is...
Charm and charisma.
When Margaret Thatcher became Britain's Prime Minister, Helmut Schmidt went around saying to all the other opinion leaders, this is going to be awful. She's the most dreadful bitch. But then he pitched up in London and they got on really well. Because she kind of had a bit of a fancy for kind of chain smoking
cads.
Yeah,
he's kind of Cecil Parkinson.
He was, exactly.
Looks, didn't he?
And when he used to come right to, they used to meet up, she used to say to him, I love talking to you because you're the only world leader I ever meet who's more right wing than I am. Because he, although he's in the SPD, he's very kind of hard line on something because he'd become very hard line economically. So, I'm a great fan of Helmut Schmidt. I think he's a great character.
Very, very charismatic, perhaps in a way that quite a lot of German chancellors
Like Ted Heath, he was very big on the piano. He recorded piano music. He was arrested in later life for smoking against the smoking ban.
Massive lad.
Yeah, massive lad, exactly. Yeah. Contributed an article to a Festschrift for the philosopher Karl Popper. I mean... Yeah.
He's the complete chancellor.
He's the German... I mean, maybe apart from the war, he's the German chancellor you'd want to be, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Now, maybe at this moment we should take a break. We haven't got to Angela Merkel yet, but I mean, maybe that's the story.
But
of
we have the huge bulk of Helmut Kohl looming towards us. So let's take a quick break, and then when we get back,
More
Germans. Don't go away, Germans. We've got them.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. Today I read on Twitter from a satisfied listener to our James Bond podcast that what was great about The Rest is History's Bond podcast was that it wasn't full of the flippancy and cliches that you get from so many podcasts. Whether people will say that about this podcast, about post-war German politics, remains to be seen. But as Tom said, we now confront the vast bulk of Helmut Kohl. So Helmut Kohl is probably the German chancellor who gives German chancellors not exactly a bad name. I mean, he's a colossus, isn't he? He's a political
in
colossus.
In every sense.
But he is quite boring.
But isn't, again, I mean, we've said this throughout. That
the boringness
that
is the point.
Being boring is a quality.
Yeah.
And if you're not boring, then there's a faint hint of suspicion. I guess as happens with Schmidt.
Schmidt famously said there was talk about German politics lacking vision. And Schmidt said, you know, if you're seeing visions, you need to consult a doctor.
Yeah.
And I think, yes, and some listeners to the podcast will say, oh, this giggling about politicians being boring is typical of a British flippancy and a sort of deliberate nihilistic silliness, which has, you know, sort of landed Britain in all
has
kinds
resulted
of,
in Boris.
Right. And that actually, you know, why are you laughing at Helmut Kohl being boring when actually Helmut Kohl is an incredibly serious and important figure?
Well, indeed, you know, the father of modern Germany. Do you know who called him that? Margaret Thatcher.
Right. Well, Margaret Thatcher, of course, and Helmut
when
Kohl
he died.
Have this terrible relationship.
But she admired him.
They're both on the centre-right. So she can't forgive him for German reunification, which she, I mean, she famously, you know what she says about German reunification? We defeated the Germans twice and now they're back, which is obviously not
well,
very Mitterrand constructive.
Well, basically felt the same, didn't he? The president of France.
I mean, but he didn't admit, he didn't say it publicly.
No, he didn't say it publicly, but he was kind of, you know, phoning up Mrs. Thatcher and they were...
Yeah, bemoaning with each
other.
Moaning
away about the Germans.
Of course.
But Mitterrand,
I mean, there's this. I can't remember whether we talked. I think we did talk about this, but I enjoy it, so I'll talk about it again on our Anglo-German relations podcast. So she went over to visit Helmut Kohl in Germany, And this is, they're obviously both centre-right leaders. They're both, you know, invested in the Cold War. They're
so
both
he's,
friends.
He's CDU, he's Catholic, he's from the Rhine.
Yes. I mean, they should get on fine. Yeah. And actually, he's determined that they will get on fine. And he takes her to the Palatinate, Rhineland Palatinate, where he's from. And he takes her to his hometown of Oggersheim. I mean, well, I think all German politicians should come from somewhere called Oggersheim. He takes her to his favourite restaurants, and they have a lot of sausages and stuff. And then he takes her to the cathedral in Speyer, in the Palatinate, where 8 Holy Roman emperors are buried.
Yeah, I've been there.
Have you? Is it a good cathedral?
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, if you love 10th and 11th century German history, there's nowhere better.
Which I do. Yeah. Oh, then,
I took the children there.
And he takes, did you? God, well, you should have gone with Margaret Thatcher. So Helmut Kohl, or with Helmut Kohl. So he takes her in, and while they're behind a pillar or something, he says to Charles Pole, her foreign policy guy, he says, this is really important for me, this. This is the quote, it's absolutely crucial that Mrs. Thatcher knows I consider myself a European first and a German second. And he takes her around, he shows her the tombs and all that, and then she leaves. And the first thing she says is, my God, that man is so German. And of course, he is very German.
Yeah.
He wouldn't work in Britain, but he works in Germany precisely because of the lack of colour, lack of vision, all of those kinds of things.
But to Mrs. Thatcher's credit, I think, you know, the father of modern Germany, she wouldn't just say that.
No,
I mean,
no.
She didn't,
well, he is,
you know,
the father
come
of
out
modern
with
Germany.
Guff. And clearly she could recognise, despite the fact that she didn't like him in the way that she'd obviously liked Schmidt, that he was a titanic figure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which he clearly was.
Because
he is the Chancellor who presides over the reunification of Germany.
And they do it so quickly, within a year.
So quickly and effectively and efficiently. And
yeah. I mean, it's very costly at the time. Costly for everybody. It's costly for East Germans because they are disadvantaged. You know, they're economically disadvantaged and so on. But, you know, in the long run, it obviously worked and turned Germany into the powerhouse that it now is. There's an argument that had he delayed, you know, people would have started to find objections and so on, but he really went for it. For a very kind of stolid-looking man, it was an act of almost swashbuckling kind of decisiveness. Absolutely played. He had a very sad ending, Helmut Kohl. So he had, I don't know if it was a stroke or something like that, but basically while he was in hospital, he ended up marrying somebody who was about 40 years younger than himself, who then kept him, well, this is contested, but basically his family claimed that she kept him as a virtual prisoner, and he fell out with the whole of the rest of his family. Very sad story. So that was the end of him. Anyway, he was replaced by a man who...
Absolute shyster.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to say that? Absolute.
So Gerhard Schroeder really shouldn't be a German politician. No, I mean, he's a British
shocker.
Politician.
Yes.
He's a sort of Tory MP from the major government or something.
Yes, he is. He's made a fortune, kind of, flogging second-hand cars.
So his father was killed in World War II when he was a baby in Romania. He's a Lutheran. Well, nominally, I think he's actually an atheist. Grew up in Westphalia. Supposedly in 1982...
Are you reading this off from Wikipedia?
No, I'm reading off from my notes. I'm reading off from my notes.
Sorry.
1982, he supposedly visited the Federal Chancellery drunk and shouted, I want to get in. And eventually he did in 1988.
Amazing story.
Because
he was quite... I mean, he was quite...
He's Blairite.
He was quite hard left.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then
moved.
And then he gets into power and he basically chums up with Tony.
Yeah, you should love him. He's third way. He's pure third way. So Blair, Clinton, and Schroeder.
And he really
with
goes kind of very, very... his economic policies are really quite right-wing.
Yeah. But I think actually the truth of the matter is politically, he's been completely eclipsed by his behaviour. So he's been married 5 times. You know what the Germans call him? The Lord of the Rings. So previously,
unbelievably, say Germans have no sense of humour.
Yeah, previously they called him, when he was married 4 times, his nickname was Audi Man. And then now they call him Olympic Man. I mean, he's a parody. His wives have become progressively younger. But the other thing is the Russia
his
stuff.
His hair. I mean,
his hair is shocking. Paul McCartney's sort of level. The other shocking thing about Gerhard Schroeder is the Russia stuff. So,
yes. which is a story that will run with Merkel as well.
Yeah, he became a lobbyist for Gazprom and Rosneft and all these Russian companies. And, you know, he spent his 70th birthday party in the Yusupov Palace in St. Petersburg, and the guest of honour was Vladimir Putin. And there's no doubt, I mean, he's being paid for a lot of this. You know, he's just become, as you say, a complete and utter shill, basically, for the Putin regime.
And he's so, kind of huge behind the Nord Stream, the Russian gas directly to Germany and bypassing Ukraine. And
so I think we're going to come to that, because this is obviously one of Angela Merkel's great legacies, is the Nord Stream gas pipeline. So now we've come to Angela. And of course, this will be music to your ears, because her religious background
is crucial.
Is very important.
Which is why she opens the last chapter in Dominion.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah,
I'm not blanking out Dominion. Yeah. I mean, like Calais, it's engraved on my heart.
But, so each chapter begins with a scene. You know, 21 chapters spanning 2,500 years. And the last one is Angela Merkel on TV in Rostock with a Palestinian girl who's a refugee who's come to Rostock for medical treatment and now has to go back. And she asks Merkel, why do I have to go back? I don't want to go back. And Merkel says, well, basically that's tough. It's the way things are. You know, we can't have everyone over here. And the girl bursts into tears and Merkel looks embarrassed. And then a few weeks later, in the face of the great migrant crisis, refugees from Syria and Afghanistan and so on crossing Europe, she unexpectedly opens the borders. And my thesis, which is not original to me, because I think lots of people think it, is that this is very powerfully influenced by the parable of the Good Samaritan, which she would have absolutely absorbed at the feet of her father, who was a Lutheran pastor who, very unlike most people at the end of the war, are going from East Germany to West Germany. He goes from Hamburg to Berlin to keep the Lutheran fire alive in what's obviously going to become communist East Germany.
But it's not just the Lutheranism, though, is it? Isn't it also her sense of what we've been talking about in this podcast, of German history and of German guilt and German's obligations, obligations to the world?
Absolutely. But I also wonder, her father, when he goes there, there's this kind of Lutheran idea that, of church and state, that you don't really worry about what the state is. You focus on the church, which kind of enables him morally to live and work in East German society. But obviously Merkel is still a kind of devout Lutheran, and it obviously does inform her morality and her politics and her seriousness, I think.
Yeah.
But when the Berlin Wall comes down and East Germany becomes part of West Germany and, fused into the Federal Republic, she joins the CDU, the Conservatives, and Catholics, and she's a Lutheran. But I think that her father was called Red Kasner. So her father was, that was her maiden name. I wonder whether, as well as a kind of Christian commitment, she also inherited from that experience a kind of mistrust of wild idealism of the kind that her father had shown by going to East Germany. I don't know.
Her mother was deeply opposed to the move east. So they went against the mother's wishes. And obviously the fact that he was called, I find that fascinating that he was called Red Kasner, because I think he's called that because he clearly has left of centre sympathies.
Definitely. And that's what enables her to get the great education that she does.
Yeah. Because what's interesting about her as well is that, and actually this does tie in with some previous chances, to Helmut Schmidt and the people who are in the Hitler Youth and so on. She is in, she works there's a lot of argument about this in Germany, about exactly what she did. But she probably worked as a propaganda officer for the sort of the main, state-sponsored communist youth organization in the GDR. She was never anything vaguely, remotely resembling a dissident. And she's completely, she's been completely open about that. She sort of said it would be career suicide. It would be, very damaging for my family. And this is obviously true of, millions upon millions of people in East Germany. She kept her head down and, sort of got on with it. And
well, she's not a radical. And it's always safety first.
Yeah,
and the famous story, isn't it, that when the Berlin Wall comes down, that she goes and has a look. Yeah, and then she goes back because she's got to get up and she's got work the next morning.
Exactly. Absolutely. Exactly right. And I think, she She won big student Russian competition. She worked, you know, she had her head down for years, you know, we're talking about 10 years or more in science. You know what her thesis is, her research paper, Tom? Do you know the title of her research paper?
I don't.
It's Vibrational Properties of Surface Hydroxyls, Non-Empirical Model Calculations, Including Anharmonicities.
Well, what does that tell you?
Nothing. I don't know what any of that means.
Well, I guess what it might tell you is that, I mean, she has a Lutheran background.
Yeah.
She obviously has a background in hard science.
Yes.
Science operates according to
And you know
to
who
laws,
this is? This property. Is leading us towards, who she's yes. very similar to.
Yes, yes, in so many ways, and yet in so many ways not, to Mrs. Thatcher, I guess.
Yeah,
say.
To Margaret Thatcher. I think it's both scientists, both from, you know, what we would call nonconformist or sort of low church backgrounds, and both consistently underestimated by their male opponents until the moment when they reveal themselves more opportunistic, more cunning. You know, well, Helmut Kohl, she ended up stabbing him in the back at the end of the 1990s.
So he appoints her fairly quickly.
He does.
As Minister for Women in the CDU.
Just like Ted Heath and Margaret Thatcher, actually, she comes on board as a token woman. She's a pure... And Cole patronises her dreadfully. He goes around, he says, this is my matron, this is my girl kind of thing. You know, this is my little mascot from the East who I'm showing off. And he introduces someone like George Bush Senior in this incredibly condescending way. I mean, this is a woman who's been a research scientist for 10 years in the East. And then, you know, quietly all the time, people call her the snake in the 90s.
But the contrast with Mrs. Thatcher is that Mrs. Thatcher kind of made a virtue out of, you know, the smoke and crash of battle.
Yeah.
I mean, she would advance towards fire.
Yes.
Whereas
yes.
Merkel, it seems, has always done the opposite.
Yes, she has. And this is the criticism that you read in a lot of the commentary, that...
Well, it's not necessarily criticism, is it?
Well, no, because it's work. It's short, brilliant short-term politics, right?
But is it not also going with the grain of what Germans want?
Probably is. Probably right.
Because, again, if you compare it to Britain, one of the things about British politics that is Merkel's criticism of it is that it's flippant, it's short-term, it...
Yeah, unnecessarily sensationalist and aggressive.
Sensationalist,
and, yeah.
Kind of, you know, rolling things on a throw of the dice, all that kind of stuff. Which you might say reflects the fact that Britain didn't undergo a fascist dictatorship, wasn't kind of, you know, defeated in two world wars, wasn't divided, didn't have, a quarter of the country under communist dictatorship. So Britain is able to kind of treat recent history in a faintly flippant manner.
Yeah.
In a way that Germans can't.
That's
and
absolutely
shouldn't.
Right. Yeah, absolutely right. That she has. How would you not have that sense if you'd grown up in East Germany? And if you'd grown up with that, the experience of the two world wars, the Holocaust and so on, Nazism hanging over you, as all Germans have to this day. The interesting question, I suppose, is when that runs out. You know, when will German politics become flippant? And
So if you think of Johnson with his kind of ironic postmodern yet also faintly serious identification with Churchill.
Yeah.
But it's all a bit of a joke. It's a kind of Oxford Union debating pose.
Yeah.
And you contrast that with the palpable influence that the experience of growing up under a communist dictatorship has had on Merkel. You know, the difference in seriousness is obviously immense. I mean, who is to say perhaps extreme seriousness can be overdone, because I do think obviously the Johnsonian approach is all about let's create chaos, let's throw the dice, let's see what happens, and you know, as the queues at petrol stations grow, we can see what some of the consequences of that might be. But equally, I suppose one of the criticism of Merkelism would be that she's incredibly reactive.
Yeah.
Is that fair? I mean,
yeah, I think it probably is fair.
Waits for crisis to blow up, and then she kind of responds to them.
Exactly.
And she often responds to them in ways that aren't necessarily great.
Well, a classic example would be the Eurozone. So, you know, if you're listening to the podcast from Portugal, Ireland, Greece, or Spain, your take on Angela Merkel might be very different from, you know, somebody's taken Germany. You would say she punished us. She made us clients of you know, German manufacturing, made it impossible for us ever to be competitive because of the austerity put in place with that came with the bailouts at the beginning of the 2010s. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a sort of fantasy that, you know, which by the way, is brilliant politics that, you know, I'm a pure pragmatic scientist.
But I'm also an idealist.
Right. Making the right decisions, but kind decisions in the national interest. And that is yeah, the mutti kind of. Yes. Exactly. I'm the nanny.
You've
mummy
got
knows
to go
best.
To bed early because it's for your own good because you've got school tomorrow.
And it's slightly different. It's interesting that sort of that female archetype. I mean, I think one of the great stories of politics actually in the last 30, 40 years is what a terrible time women politicians have.
Well, she hates the nickname, doesn't she?
And she does. And how subject they really are to stereotypes. I mean, Margaret Thatcher was always seen as the nurse who gives you the really harsh medicine. I mean, she sort of embraced that herself. Or the doctor who prescribes, you know, you need to have both legs amputated to save your life. Merkel, it's exactly the mother who tucks you up at night with kind of soothing words. You know, she gives you, you know, the mother who serves you porridge, basically. She's not giving you something really horrible, not giving you something terribly nice either. But she, that sort of mother of the nation thing is part of her, is a very successful part of her persona. And actually, you know, you were the contrast with Johnson. Different political personas work in different environments. I mean, you've talked about this with Rome, with somebody like Nero. I mean, I know it's a ridiculous comparison, but different.
Well,
I mean, I think a politician needs to adjust their presentation to the expectations of the society they're living in. And what works in one will not work. You know, Theresa May is actually in some ways a very good comparison with Angela Merkel. And she didn't work in Britain. She would have probably worked much better in Germany.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, another kind of interesting contrast with Germany and both Britain and France is that when there was that tsunami and the nuclear reactor in Japan got crippled, that Merkel's response was actually one of seems of panic, closed down all nuclear reactors, with the result that Germany now, its carbon footprint is twice that of France or Britain.
I think the colossal amount of their energy they get from fossil fuels, something like a third or a quarter.
Which is also going back to the Nord Stream.
Right, well, this could be her biggest legacy, I think, actually.
So, obviously, we're recording this at a time when people are saying that there may be power cuts in Britain because of the lack of gas, and we've got queues of petrol stations and all kinds of things. So energy crisis seems very salient here. But actually, Germany's energy crisis is, in the long term, kind of much more crippling.
Well, is it an energy crisis? I mean, they've got a deal with Russia.
Well, it depends if you put the energy crisis in the context of global warming, of the kind of the macro level that actually, to give him credit, Johnson at least is affecting to care about.
Talk about with his Muppets references.
His references to Sophocles, to be fair to him. But part of the one of the kind of consequences of Johnsonian flippancy is that you can just suddenly kind of change your mind. You know, I mean, he was massively anti-green, and now suddenly he's going on about Kermit.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's all kinds of questions about that Nord Stream project. So for people who don't know, this is, as Tom said, this is this pipeline that goes basically from Russia to Germany. It bypasses Eastern Europe, the Baltic states. So what it does is it makes Germany dependent on Russian natural gas. But it means that, in a way, you can sell out those countries in between those two places. And actually, Germany, the stories that's never reported in Britain or America about Germany, it's in the last 10 years, Germany has become one of Russia's key trading partners. There are all kinds of links.
We talk about China's, Gerhard, right?
Yeah, and China's. We talk all kinds of things. We talk about Gerhard Schroeder, sort of lobbying links and all these kinds of things between Germany and Russia. Angela Merkel spoke to Vladimir Putin every week on the phone.
I mean, even though she hated dogs.
Well, he did this
weird... notoriously...
Yeah. It's weird that he would do that when
she's
one of his pals, that he got this big black Labrador to sort of stalk around her. And I mean, the photos are actually...
Well, that's kind of... KGB one-upmanship.
Very, yeah. But she, they would speak sometimes in Russian. They'd speak in, he speaks German, she speaks Russian. And she believed that she had a, almost a unique insight among Western leaders into Russia's mindset.
But, I mean, against that, so against the fact that she has cozied up to Russian gas suppliers and so on, and she's cut Viktor Orban a lot of slack, because even though they obviously have completely contradictory opinions, say, on refugees, a lot of German manufacturing is in Hungary and so on. So she's very kind of practical, maybe cynical, one might say, on that score. Mm-hmm. But I think she... I mean, the reason that Remainers in Britain love her is that she has put the integrity of the European Union and Germany's dominant position within it kind of centre stage. So to that extent, she has kind of stuck up for Western values.
Well, I think she has a vision of the EU that absolutely does have Germany centre stage. And I think Germany is more, now that Britain has left the EU, obviously Germany is now 20% of the population, more than 20% of the GDP. France is probably the only counterweight. I mean, effectively, the EU has become more and more a German.
And it's interesting with so project. Obviously the Franco-German relationship throughout this period has been central, right the way back to Adenauer.
Yeah, far more than Anglo-German.
Oh, I mean, completely. But you know, Kohl and Mitterrand,
holding
standing
hands
together in cemeteries is kind of one of the defining images of the '80s, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, again, Macron has been pushing Merkel to kind of beef up European defence. I mean, that's the backdrop to the bust up with the British and American Australian submarine thing. Is that actually it's not only Britain that's let him down; it's also Germany.
The French want a friend. They just want a friend.
Well, Macron wants a Europe that, you know, as every French president has done, wants a Europe that can, and led by France, that is effectively independent of America.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
He's been pushing Merkel to do that, and she hasn't wanted to do it.
Well, I mean, that's partly because of this legacy that's hung over the whole podcast. Yeah. The World War legacy. I mean, this sort of, I know this seems like a parody of a sort of British history podcast talking about Germany. They're kind of Basil Fawlty, don't mention the war. But I don't think you can not mention it. I think it's absolutely, you know, you visit Berlin now and it is still there. And what it gave Germans was a consciousness unmatched in Europe of the sort of dangers of militarism, the damage that impassioned political rhetoric can do. I mean, just to describe the horrors that Germans endured in the 20th century, the dictatorships of left and right, you know, it's you're in a different universe from anything in Britain or indeed in France, actually, even with the occupation.
The other thing that we haven't really talked about, and it reflects the fact we're definitely not a politics podcast, is of course that it's almost always dependent on coalitions.
Yes.
And we see that now that basically, you know, the CDU and SPD both got the same, basically the kind of same number of votes. And so there's going to be lots of horse trading. And so probably Merkel will remain chancellor for weeks, maybe months.
Yeah. So you don't get the bear pit adversarialism.
Yeah. And so that obviously also is a difference and is a structural one, again, designed to keep the spectre of dictatorship at bay. That's not in any way a profound observation.
No, I think it's a good observation.
I thought we should kind of just chuck that into the mix.
I think, do you know what, Tom? The producer said to us before we started, maybe 20, 25 minutes, and we've whittled on for an hour. So I think we should definitely call a halt. And I will go off to contemplate my signed photographs of Helmut Schmidt. And... you can go and do whatever German activity seems to you fitting.
I'm actually going to go and watch the Sopranos film.
Oh, very good.
Which isn't German at all.
This is this is exactly the sort of louche life that the listeners will...
It's the kind of lifestyle that I'm advertising on The Guardian.
Talking of films, we are doing a very exciting event, aren't we?
We are in the Odeon Leicester Square.
At the Odeon Leicester Square. This is the first time we've spoken about it publicly on this podcast. It's on the 14th.
We're going to be doing
of November.
14th of November. We're going to be doing history and the cinema.
Yeah,
in so, cinema.
In what could be more appropriate? And I don't think the tickets have yet gone on sale. Maybe they have, maybe they haven't. Check our channels on Twitter. We will advertise the tickets. There are lots of them. We'd love to see as many listeners as possible. We should be talking about some very entertaining films, some controversial choices as well.
Including one that I think I described as the worst portrayal of a bottom in cinema history.
Well, if that's not enough to get you, yeah. I mean, what else would you rather be doing on a Sunday afternoon? So on that note, we will see you next time. Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. Bye-bye.
Auf Wiedersehen. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.